If you would please open your Bible to the Old Testament book of Ruth. Some of you and I were involved in a Bible study recently, and we were studying or just scoping over the book of Judges, citing the circumstances that exist in that book. And I want to give a background for our study tonight from the book of Judges. In the book of Judges, we note in Judges chapter 2, reading beginning in verse 6. Now, we're going to be doing quite a little bit of reading from the text tonight, so a Bible would be helpful to you. In Judges chapter 2, reading beginning in verse 6, the writer said, "When Joshua had sent the children away, the children of Israel went every man into his inheritance to possess the land. And the people served Jehovah all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of Jehovah that he had wrought for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, a servant of Jehovah, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the borders of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, on the north of the mountain of Gash. And also all that generation were gathered together to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them that knew not Jehovah, nor yet the work which he had wrought for Israel." Now the next verse tells us, "And the children of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and served the Baalim." Now the interesting fact about that is they have affirmed their faithfulness to God. As Joshua challenges them in Joshua chapter 24, verse 15, "To choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods that are beyond the river, or the gods of your fathers that are beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah." And they affirm confidently, "We're going to be faithful to God. We're not going to leave him. We'll be faithful. We'll serve him the rest of our days." And then Joshua dies, and the next verse tells us that they were gathered together with their fathers, and we've got another generation on the scene that knew not Jehovah nor all the things that he did in Israel. And now they're worshiping idols. Contrary to what Joshua had challenged them to do, contrary to what they had said they would do. And that cycle repeats about 15 times in about 300 years in the book of Judges. And as the book of Judges closes in chapter 21, verse 25, the writer tells us, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes." Now we might like to think that Joshua was writing about us, or Judges, as the record goes, that it's writing about conditions concerning us. Well, the writer is not describing us, although the same things are applicable when anybody or any generation chooses to abandon God and just do what you want to. Now, it's against that backdrop that we read then the book of Ruth. Very short little book, only four chapters. And as we might note through a more detailed study of the book of Judges, that time frame was a time of just moral chaos. They were doing as they pleased. They were an evil, violent generation of people. And the book of Ruth, set during this time, or in the book of Ruth, set during this time, we learn how that God works in the lives of those who are faithful. And one of the things that we might observe is that during the period of the judges, not everybody was evil. There's always been a remnant of people that would serve the Lord. And Ruth would represent at least one of those, and Naomi, as we want to note, in the context of the book of Ruth. We'll talk about that more as our study develops. But be it understood that this is a very dark time in the history of the nation of Israel. And during this time of spiritual distress and even physical deprivation, we know that Naomi's husband takes the family away from their homeland around Bethlehem and takes them over into the land of Moab. Now the reason is given, as you'll note in verse 1, let's read from the book of Ruth, chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. It says, "And it came to pass in the days when the judges judged, that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. and the name of his two sons, Malchon and Chilion, Ephratites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. And Malchon and Chilion died, both of them, and the woman was left of her two children and her husband. Now get the picture. We've got them traveling into a distant place where evidently there was food, where evidently it had rained. But in the land of Judah, there was no rain. There was famine. And in the process of time, Naomi's husband died, leaving her with the two boys. They married women in the land of Moab, and then the two boys died. Now, we're not told a great deal of detail any more than this about why they died or how they died. We don't know that. But what we do know is here we now have an older woman with her two daughters-in-law in the land of Moab. Naomi is an Israelite. And now she has these daughter-in-laws that are from the land of Moab. They are not Israelites. And idolatry was nonetheless practiced in the land of Moab. But evidently, the sons of Elimelech have converted these women. At least Ruth, we see that to be the case, and we'll talk more about that as we look a little bit later in this chapter. But these daughters-in-law are given the opportunity now by Naomi to go to their own houses, and God be kind to you. You'll see that in verse 8. In verse 9, Jehovah grant you that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. And she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. And they said unto her, nay, but we will return with thee to thy people. No, we're going to go back with you to the land of Bethlehem. And Naomi said, turn again, my daughters, why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that ye may, or that they may be your husbands? Turn away, my daughters, for your way, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say, I hope, if I should even have a husband tonight, and should also bear sons, would ye therefore tarry till they were grown? Would you therefore stay from having husbands? Nay, my daughters. For it grieveth me much for your sake, for the hand of Jehovah has gone forth against me. And they lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave to her. Now get the picture of what we're looking at here. Naomi tells these girls, go home. Now the custom, the practice of the Jews, according to the law, was that if a husband died and he doesn't have any children, then his brother would take his wife, and we've studied this in the New Testament, as we see evidence in Matthew chapter 22. Take his wife and bring up children to his brother's honor. Well, the problem here was Naomi's old, and she's past the age of bearing children. She's not going to marry again. She's not going to have any more children. And even if that was possible, she asked these daughter-in-laws, would you wait until my children, boys perhaps, were old enough to become your husbands? Well, no, that's a legitimate question. She's saying, go home. Find you a new husband and have children because my boys are dead. And Orpah does. But then we read about Ruth. In verse 16 it says, and Ruth said, entreat not me not to leave thee and to return from following after thee. For whether thou goest, I will go, and whether thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. Jehovah do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part me and thee. Now this passage becomes familiar to us. We've all probably heard this read, or read it a number of times. But let's talk a little bit about this setting. We note that Elimelech takes his family to Moab, and there's a lot of reasons that you might want to go someplace else besides Moab. For example, when we read of the history of the Moabitish people, it takes us back to the Old Testament book of Genesis chapter 19. Look with me in the text. Genesis chapter 19, and begin reading at verse 30. It says that Lot went up to Zoar and dwelt... dwelt in the mountain, and his two daughters with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar, and he dwelt in the cave, he and his two daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father." And they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he knew not when she lay down, nor when she rose up, or arose. And it came to pass on the morrow that the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, I lay yesternight with my father. Let us make him drink wine this night also, and go thou in and lie with him, that we may preserve seed for our father." Now you get the picture, don't you? We've got an incestuous relationship with these two girls and their father because they've gotten him drunk. It says in verse 35, "And they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he knew not when she lay down nor when she arose. Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. And the firstborn bare a son and called his name Moab. The same is the father of the Moabites unto this day." Now you'll notice in the next verse the origin of the Ammonite people. Now these are peoples that we become familiar with in our study of history and geography of the Bible. We've talked about the geography of where these people live. We'll talk about Moab and the Moabites and where they live in our study tonight. But the origin of the Moabite people finds its place in Genesis chapter 19 in this incestuous relationship between the daughters of Lot and Lot. Well, that's not very desirable, is it? No, well, that's just sinful. And then as you read on concerning the development of these people, and read in Numbers chapter 22 through chapter 24. Now, a lot of folks read this text and they're just not impressed with some of these Old Testament texts and find that boring. Frankly, I find it rather exciting to study the history of where these people began, because these are the relatives of the people of Israel that they're going to have to deal with in generation after generation after generation. And when we look at the development of the Moabite people, the king of Moab hired Balaam to curse the people of Israel. Now that rings a bell to you. You remember that in every effort that Balaam set forth to curse the people, it wound up being nothing more than a blessing to the people. And then Balaam told the king of Moab, "If you want to find disfavor of God toward these people, then you need to send the Moabitish women among the Israelite men to commit fornication with the Israelite men, and that will obtain the disfavor of God." Now you can read about that in the book of Numbers, and you can read about that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and you'll note that about 24,000 people died because of this sin. Well, that might not be persuasive to not go to Moab, but it would be something I would factor in. How about you? And then when you read further about the period of the judges, you recall that when the people of Israel were doing wrong things and they were rebelling against God, that Eglon, the king of Moab, raised up and became one of the oppressors of the Israelite people. He was killed by the judge Ehud. As you read about those things, maybe that don't impress you, but I'd suggest that the history of Israel with these people is not good. And if you're going to take your family to a place, I probably would not choose the land of Moab, would you? Because of some of these things. And then when you look at the Moabite culture, you can read in 2 Kings chapter 3, as we have noted, and see the background of their worship. They did not worship God. They engaged in the worship of idols like many of the inhabitants around the people of God. Now I mentioned this, that there was a famine in the land of Israel. And Amalek has taken his family to Moab because likely there's something to eat in Moab. And he was there for a period of time before he died and then before his sons died. Now let's look at that on the map. See where these places are. Here's the land of Israel. We've been discussing that in our class back in the back, from the river Euphrates up here down to the river of Egypt to the south. And when Joshua led them in, he led them in across the river of Jordan on dry ground, and we've discussed that. But I want to note with you where on the map Bethlehem is. and where on the map Moab is, so you could see this region of Moab. This is where the Moabites lived. And this is where that Amalek and his family have traveled from. Now, this map doesn't display it very well, but the topography of this area, in order to get to Moab, it's a difficult travel of about 30 to 60 miles, depending on how you would have to travel. But mountains here, mountains and desert here, and some of the lowest area on earth down through this place. So it's not going to be an easy task to get there, and once there, it's not going to be an easy task to get home. And we might think 30 to 60 miles, well, that's not very far. It would be if you happened to travel terrain like this without an air-conditioned automobile. Now, you can tour this part of the world in a bus currently, but I dare say that Amalek didn't ride in a bus. Now, our point is a simple one. Our point is to study about Ruth. Ruth is a Moabite. This is her background. This is her culture. But evidently, Amalek and Naomi and the family have persuaded her, at least, to become a servant of God. And we see that, I think, expressed in this expression that we read, "Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God." That speaks well concerning Ruth. She's not willing to pursue the idolatrous life of the Moabites. She wants to serve God, and she wants to be close to Naomi. Now, having said that, we see the extent of that commitment. "Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. Jehovah do so to me and more also, if aught but death part me and thee." Ruth has taken upon herself the responsibility to care for her mother-in-law. Now, there's no blood relation between Naomi and Ruth, but obviously there's a very close tie between them. And she's taken it upon herself for the welfare. She's very loyal to Naomi. If you'll drop down in this text, in verse 14, I guess, is the one that I want to read. It says, "They lifted up their voice and wept, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave to her." She would cleave to Naomi. And the level of the commitment that she's made is not only seen in these verses, but especially later as women speak to Naomi about the relationship she has with Ruth. In the fourth chapter, if you'll drop down in the reading of this to verse 15, it says, "And he shall be unto thee a restorer of life and a nourisher of thine own age. For thy daughter-in-law, who loveth thee, who is better to thee than seven sons, hath borne him." We'll talk about who the child was when we get to it. But here's a comment that the women are making to Naomi about Ruth. "She's better to you than seven sons would have been." That speaks volumes about the character and the commitment that Ruth has expressed toward her mother-in-law. Now, we know that loyalty is very important, isn't it? Isn't loyalty important to you? Loyalty to God and to His Word. Joshua impressed that upon the minds of these folks, as we noted a few moments ago from Joshua 24, verse 15. "Choose you this day whom ye will serve." We see that the people were faithful through the life of Joshua, but when Joshua died, they're about their own business and they forgot all about the great things that God has done. And in Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning in verse 4, they were to teach these things to their children and to their children's children, so that they would not depart from God, so that they would be faithful and loyal. But by the time we get to the book of Judges, they're not faithful and loyal. Somebody has abandoned the responsibility of teaching, and somebody has abandoned, obviously, the responsibility of learning, because we've got another generation on the scene that don't know God at all, or the mighty works that He wrought in Israel. Now, if we talk about loyalty, shouldn't we see loyalty in the family relationships? Loyalty is a really great thing, isn't it? In fact, we learn in Genesis chapter 2 of the beginning of the family or marriage relationship. And in Genesis chapter 2, we read beginning in verse 24, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Here we see a lifetime commitment. One man, one woman, for life. That's the kind of commitment we see in the marriage relationship. Would you agree that loyalty in the marriage relationship is essential? This question was asked of the Lord in the familiar text of Matthew chapter 19 in verse 3, where the Pharisees came to Jesus testing him, asking him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? In other words, can a man divorce his wife for just anything? And Jesus said, have ye not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife and the two shall be one flesh? Be impressed with that. Jesus answered their question by citing the relevant passage of the law that answered their question. Isn't that what they want to know? Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause? Jesus said, hadn't you read that this is to be a permanent relationship? Leave and cleave. And his comment on that was, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. So to answer their question, can you divorce your wife for just any cause? Jesus said, no. Well, they want to implement the law once again, quoting Moses from Deuteronomy 24. And Jesus said what Moses said in Deuteronomy 24 was because of the hardness of your heart. But from the beginning, it's not been so, not so. So to answer their question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause, or does there need to be loyalty in that relationship? Well, no, it's not lawful to divorce for just any cause. Now Jesus said you may for one cause, but only one. And that cause is the cause of fornication. Where a man's wife becomes unfaithful to him, she's not loyal to him, and she has a sexual relationship with another man, then the innocent man can divorce her for this cause. And he can marry another. Now what about her? Well, no, she can't marry another, because she's the one that's guilty of sin. She don't profit by her sin. Neither do we. Loyalty. Well, that's required in the marriage relationship. And how about our children? Is there loyalty involved in that element of the family relationship? Well, children are to obey your parents and the Lord. What about parents teaching your children? Well, yes, you're obligated to teach them and to bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And even in these Old Testament texts of Exodus chapter 12 and Joshua chapter 4, Exodus chapter 12 was the institution of the Passover Supper. And it was to be a memorial for the nation of Israel so that every year they could teach their children what God had done to bring them up out of the land of Egypt. And then in Joshua chapter 4, there was a pillar of stones that was erected in the city of Gilgal. So that when their children, their grandchildren were passing that way and they'd ask, what means this pillar of stones? They could use that as an occasion to teach their children. I asked you, may recall, in the Bible class, we were discussing that element from Joshua chapter 4 this last Thursday. And I asked the question, would it be a correct answer when their children would ask, what does this pillar of stones mean? To say, this is where we crossed over the Jordan River and came into the promised land. Is that a correct answer? Well, Terry, as you like to use the expression, that's academically correct. But have they taught the lesson that God intended to be taught? Well, what is the lesson? The lesson is not the identifying place, but how that God stopped the waters of the Jordan River and we crossed over on dry ground, and that was indicative that God was with us when we came into this land. So teach the lesson. Teach your children. Here is an element of loyalty. Children, you obey your parents in the Lord. Fathers, you teach your children. And what about our relationship to even our grandparents? Much less our parents. We'll look over in the Bible in 1 Timothy chapter 5, and you'll note beginning in verse 4 of that text, the writer said, if any widow hath children or grandchildren, let them learn to show piety toward their own family and to requite their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. And then in verse 8, but if any provides not for his own, and especially his own household, he's denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever. Now sometimes in our reflection on loyalty in the family relationship, we think about the husband-wife relationship, we think about the parent-child relationship, only in the sense of the parent providing for the child. But what we see in this text is the child providing for the parent and even for the grandparents to requite them for the great things that has been done for them. Now, loyalty to our brethren. Well, that's important too. Our brothers and sisters in Christ. In Romans the 12th chapter, you'll read beginning in verse 9. Romans the 12th chapter, verse 9, he said, "Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. In love of the brethren be tenderly affectioned one to another. In honor, preferring one another. In diligence, not slothful, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord." We see a special relationship that exists between brethren in Christ. How many do you know of? This is a rhetorical question, just so you know. But how many do you know of that say, "Well, I wouldn't go there to worship because they're just a bunch of hypocrites"? And what we see is that being the result of people observing, well, they just fight war one with the other. Well, that's not anything new, is it? The Apostle Paul wrote to the Galatians in chapter 5, verse 15, not to do that. He said, if you do that, be careful that you're not consumed one of another. No, you can't do that. So we have loyalty that's illustrated in the various relationships of life. Now we see that displayed here with Ruth. Ruth was loyal to her mother-in-law. Well, what else do we learn about Ruth? Ruth was a very hard worker. Turn back with me to the book of Ruth, and let's notice in chapter 2, we'll read the first 7 verses. It says, "And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth." Remember that. It says, "of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, 'Let me now go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor.' And she said unto her, 'Go, my daughter.' And she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And her hap was to light on the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came to Bethlehem, and he said unto the reapers, 'Jehovah be with you.' And they answered him, 'Jehovah bless thee.' And then they said, Boaz unto his servants, rather, that was set over the reapers, 'Whose damsel is this?' And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, 'It is the Moabitess damsel that came back with Naomi out of the country of Moab. And she said, Let me glean, I pray thee, and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and hath continued even from morning until now, save that she tarried a little in the house." Now what do we notice about Ruth in this passage? Well, to glean in the fields. We tried to display somewhat of an obscure picture. It's a little blurry. But a picture of what it would be like during Bible times to harvest a crop in the fields. I don't know if some of you grew up, I think, on a farm. I did. We had a seed, a big sharp thing that you would swing like so. And we'd use that primarily to cut weeds. But I can't imagine harvesting a whole field of wheat with that thing. But what they would do is take that seed and do just that. They'd swing it and harvest the grain. And they'd shock it up. Well, you know, when you hit the grain with that sheath, some of this is going to fall on the ground. Not all of it's going to get into the shock. Now, how did they provide for folks who were needy, like Naomi and her mother-in-law? They'd leave part of it. And they'd invite the folks that were willing to come. You work. You follow the reapers and you can pick up what's left. Any of you ever do that out east of town when they're harvesting onions? Drive out in that way and see onions laying on the side of the road. And you say, "Boy, that's a big Vidalia onion. I want that." And you stop and you pick it up. Well, they are good, but that's not our point. But it illustrates the point. This is what Naomi this is what Ruth was doing to provide for her mother-in-law, Naomi. She was following the reapers around, gathering wheat in the field, that which was left by those who were harvesting the crop. In verse 14 of this same text, it says, "And at mealtime, Boaz said unto her, 'Come hither and eat of the bread, and dip thy morsel in vinegar.' And she sat beside the reapers, and they reached her parched grain. And she did eat and was sufficed, and left thereof, and when she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, 'Let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not.'" Now what's he saying? Well, it's okay if she wants to go over to the shop and get some of that too. Don't fuss at her. Let her get what she needs for herself and for her mother-in-law. And it tells us in verse 16, "And also pull out some for her from the bundles and leave it, and let her glean and rebuke her not." Do you see what Boaz is doing? He's providing a whole lot of leftovers for Naomi. and her mother-in-law. And why? Because Naomi is willing to work to have the food that she needs to eat. And you'll notice further in this text, in verse 17, it says, "And she gleaned in the field until evening. And she beat out that which she had gleaned. And it was about an ephah of barley." In verse 23 it says, "So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of the barley harvest." Well, that was about 7 weeks, just so you know, of the wheat harvest. And she dwelt. So we got her harvesting barley and wheat. And she dwelt with her mother-in-law. Now what does that tell you about Ruth? She wasn't afraid to work. She'd go in the field early and she'd stay till the end of the day when the reapers were done. And she would glean. She would pick up the leftovers so that there would be enough food for her and her mother-in-law. Well, let me ask you, is there a valuable lesson to be learned from Ruth about working? Well, yes. In the New Testament, that becomes a subject of great address. In Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 28, keep in mind that this was a letter that was written to the church in Ephesus. And would you imagine folks who profess to be Christians having to be told, you need to work? Well, indeed, if you look at the text in verse 28, it said, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing that is good, that he may have whereof to give to him that hath need." Well, now there's a powerful lesson, isn't it? Don't go out and steal what you want, but you labor with your hands so that you can have what you need and you can give somebody else. This letter written to Christians. Well, what's the concern of the apostle in writing this epistle? He's writing this to tell them, don't go back and live like you used to live. Well, does that tell us that some of them had a problem with stealing? Yes, that's what they were. They were thieves. They had a problem with telling the truth, too. They had a problem with their morals, too, as the text begins to continue on down into the 5th chapter. And the writer is telling them, don't do that. But we see illustrated in the life of Ruth, here is a young woman who's willing to work and labor from sun up to sun down. Labor hard to have the things that are the necessities of life. And if you'll turn in your Bible to the New Testament book of 2 Thessalonians, and look at the 3rd chapter, we see a cure for a lot of problems that exist in our society. It says, "For even when we were with you, we commanded you, if any will not work, neither let him eat." And you see how that society provided for the needs of those in Old Testament times. Here's an older woman and her daughter-in-law need food. All right, when the workers are in the field working, harvesting the crop, you can follow along behind them and pick up what you need. Now, how did they get their food? They worked for it. They had to pick up, they had to work from early morning till late in the day to have the necessities of life. In Ephesians chapter 6, we learn that we're to give a day's work for a day's pay. In other words, be honorable about what you do. In the wisdom literature, in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 10, the writer says, "Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in Sheol, or in the grave, whether thou goest." Now when you work, don't just work when the boss is looking. You work, and you work hard. We need to learn that. I don't think that my dad was aware of this passage, but I am absolutely confident that he knew exactly what the deal is in this passage. In Lamentation chapter 3, verse 27, the writer said, "It's good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth." Young people, listen to me. When your mom or dad asks you to do a job, don't fuss and complain about it. You get after it like you're putting out a fire. You learn to work because you're learning some life skills that you're going to need when you get older. This passage teaches that, and we see that illustrated in the book of Ruth. She worked from early morning to late in the day, following the laborers around, harvesting the crop. Well, what else do we learn about Ruth? Well, let's go back to the 1st chapter. In the 1st chapter, in verse 16, the text tells us that Ruth said, Entreat me not to leave thee, and to return from following after thee. For whether thou goest, I will go, and whether thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. What do we learn in this passage about Ruth? Well, we've learned that she was faithful to God. We've learned that she was loyal to Naomi. We've learned in the second chapter that she was a good worker. But we also learned something as we turn the page into the second chapter and read about verse 11. There it tells us that Boaz answered and said to her, "It hath been fully showed me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thy husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother and the land of thy nativity, and art come unto the people that thou knewest not heretofore," didn't know them before. "And Jehovah recompense thy work, and a full reward be given thee of Jehovah, the God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to take refuge." Now what has Boaz heard about Ruth? He's heard how that she takes care of her mother-in-law. He's heard the sacrifice that she's made to take care of her mother-in-law. She's taking care of her mother-in-law, even if it means leaving her kinsfolks. Even if it means leaving familiar country down in Moab. And here she is up in the land of Canaan, in the area of Bethlehem. And Boaz has heard all about her. Is your reputation all that important? Oh yeah, your reputation is valuable. And I would suggest this to you, dear friends, that when you cause your reputation to be marred, it takes a long time to put that back like it was. You make wise choices so that your reputation is always held in esteem. It's good. A reputation means something. When we read in Proverbs chapter 31, we read about a worthy woman who was known for the good things that she did. Reputation is important. It's important to you. And we learn that here in this little book of Ruth. The Bible tells us in Proverbs 22, verse 1, "A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold." In Ecclesiastes 7, verse 1, "A good name is better than precious oil, and the day of death and the day of one's birth." Now, why is your reputation so important? It's important to you. It sounds like rain. It's important to you because your reputation is your example before others. You're teaching people how to live. And in Matthew the 5th chapter, reading beginning in verse 13 in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "You're the salt of the earth. But if the salt had lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and trodden underfoot of men. You're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a lamp and put it under the bushel, but on the stand, and it shineth unto all that are in the house. Even so, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." Your influence, oh, it teaches people about God. It helps people to understand who God is. The life that you're trying to live is a life of teaching, and we need to underscore that. That's what your life is about. Young people, listen to that. Your reputation is important to you. We see the same point made to the Ephesians. That's why the apostle did not want them to go back and live like they used to, because their reputation was important. You've abandoned that way of life. Now you live a different way. Well, another thing that we note, because of Ruth's character, there were some blessings that came her way. Boaz cares for her. Now if you'll look in Ruth chapter 2, in verse 8, it tells us, "Then said Boaz unto Ruth, Hearest thou not, my daughter? Go not to glean in another field, neither pass from hence, but abide here fast by my maidens." You don't go to somebody else's field. You can follow my laborers, and you can glean after them. Well, what instruction had he given to his laborers? You leave things. You help her. You prepare things for her. And you'll notice in the third chapter and in verse 17 it says, "These 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said, Go not empty to thy mother." And all, what's Boaz done? Not only is she privileged to follow the laborers, and they're instructed to leave some things for her to be able to pick up, but he just plain old gave her 6 measures of barley because he knew that she was in need and she was providing for her mother-in-law. Now, if Ruth was just an evil, corrupt person, you think Boaz would have taken that kind of interest in her? I've tried to get young people and old folks alike. You do what you can to behave yourself. You do what you can to work hard. Because your labors will be rewarded if you do everything in your power to help yourself. Others will take note and they will help you because you're willing to help yourself. And do we not find that example in Ruth? No, don't just lay down and quit and wait for somebody to wait on you. That don't make anything. You do what you can to maintain your character, and then there are rewards to behaving yourself. But in the third chapter, we're introduced to something that we haven't talked about, at least not to any great degree. We notice in the third chapter, verses 1 through 18, this whole chapter, that Ruth is interested in someone redeeming her. What does that mean? That means here is a young widow. She's lost her husband. And she's interested in somebody helping her. Now, they didn't have a benevolent program like we have in the society today. This is how that Ruth is going to provide for herself and her mother-in-law. She's taken on quite a task. So she couldn't just sign a form or fill out a paper and make an application and get money. Doesn't work that way. The provisions under the law of Moses was the next of kin would assume that responsibility. Now, we've noted that Boaz is a kinsman, and he's willing to help her. But you see, there's a problem that is introduced in the third and on into the fourth chapter. And that is, there is a closer relative than Boaz. All right, so the responsibility as well as the opportunity would first fall to him, not Boaz. And so as we look at the fourth chapter now, beginning at verse 1, it says, "Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the near kinsman," that's how he's identified, "of whom Boaz spake, came by, unto whom he said, 'Ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here.' And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit ye down here.' And they sat down. And he said unto the near kinsman, 'Naomi, that is come again out of the country of Moab, selleth the parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to disclose it unto thee, saying, buy it therefore, or buy it before them rather, that sit here, and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me, that I may know, for there is none to redeem it besides thee, and I am after thee.'" Now you see the suggestion that Boaz is making. You're the closest of kin, and if you can redeem this parcel of land that Naomi has, that is, if you can buy it, then buy it. But understand with that, you have the responsibility of Naomi, and you have the responsibility of Ruth, who is a Moabite. There's been all kinds of speculation regarding this. You'll note in verse 5, it says, "Then said Boaz, 'What day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi? Thou must buy it also of Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance.' And the near kinsman said, 'I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mire mine own inheritance. Take thou my right of redemption upon thee, for I cannot redeem it.'" Now you see that there's a deal in process here. Do we not derive that from what we've read? Boaz said, "You have first option on this deal. You can buy the land. You can assume the responsibility for the well-being of Naomi and Ruth." And this closer kin fella said, "I can't do that." I said there's been a lot of speculation as to why not. Why not do that? Some have said, well, this thing that he says about his own inheritance, it would mess him up because, you see, this man was married. I don't know that. You don't know that either. But some have speculated and said, well, he couldn't do that because he already had a wife and she might not like it and create problems at home. Well, perhaps, but we don't know that. We also might note that in this equation that perhaps he feared taking upon himself the responsibility of a Moabitess woman. That might have been the issue. She's not one of our relatives. She's down here with this heathen nation that worships idolatry, or worships idols. Shemesh, I believe, was the idol they worshipped. And so I don't want to have that responsibility of an idolater. And there are some that would suggest, and perhaps more accurately, that we've noted that Boaz was a wealthy man. And to buy this parcel of land and to commit to assume the responsibility for these two women would take a certain amount of resources. And Boaz was wealthy. He had the resources. So the problem is, to this other kinsman, I can't do that. So you're the next in line. You do that if you want to do that. And so Boaz does. Now there's a lot of things that come into that equation. But what we want to note is that Ruth receives redemption from Boaz. And that's what we note in the latter part of the fourth chapter. Now, how did that all come to pass? How did that deal come about? Well, we note that eventually Ruth became the wife of Boaz and so forth, and she had a son. We'll talk about that in just a minute and the importance of that. But what we want to note at this point is that in order for this deal to take place, this nearest kinsman had to, in a public way, say, you can have her and you can buy the land and you can assume the responsibility, and to seal the deal, here is my shoe. Now, how many deals have you ever made by giving somebody a shoe? But that was the custom in Israel to do that. And he did that before witnesses. And the deal then was done. Boaz took Ruth to be his wife, and the text tells us that she had a child, and his name was Obed. I want to look at that for just a bit with you before we close, and I realize I've gone a little bit over, but I want to see the lessons that are involved in this. In chapter 4, verse 17, there the text tells us, and the woman, and the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, this child, this son, saying, there's a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed, and he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. And you see that repeated, and I'll not attempt to name all the names in verses 18 through 21. But what we see in that setting, in that paragraph, is the lineage that results from Obed. Now, why is that so important? Well, because you'll notice these names, that Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. And you remember in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 14, down through about verse 16, we notice in that text that the lineage through which Jesus would come through David. You say, well, what's that have to do with what we're talking about? Well, you'll turn in your Bible to some New Testament books. In fact, we see Matthew's account and Luke's account, as well as what we see here in Ruth chapter 4 and in the Chronicles. We see the name Obed in the lineage of Christ. Now, as you look at it in Matthew's account, we'll just look at this passage, Matthew 1. If you would please, look at verse 5. Matthew 1, verse 5. It says, and Salmon begat Boaz of Rehab, and Boaz begat Obed of Ruth, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David the king. Now, as you just keep going down that list and you look at verse 16, it says, and Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. Now, we look at this little four-chapter book and we say, it's just a story about a woman. Well, yes, she had many commendable qualities. But this woman was from Moab. She was not a Jew. But she married Boaz, who was a Jew. And her place is seen in the lineage, the genealogy of Christ. Now, if that don't impress you somewhat, then you just can't be impressed. I want us to see that. That's an important thing that we take home from this little short book, the book of Ruth. She's in the lineage of the Savior. Did you know that? What a powerful lesson. And what do we learn about her? Well, she was a good woman. She served God. She was loyal. Here's a woman that has developed character. She's hardworking. And her work is rewarded. And her place is recorded in all of the history of mankind for you to read in the lineage of Christ. And I think there's some lessons in there that we need to just pause and ponder a little while. I'm going to close our study. Maybe I'm talking to somebody tonight who is not a Christian. It would be your desire to become a Christian. You believe that Jesus is the Christ. Would you repent of your sin? That's not something to take lightly. It involves change, and people sometimes have a real hard time changing. Would you be willing to confess your faith and then to be baptized into Christ for the remission of your sin? No other way I know of to come in contact with the blood of Christ. We're baptized into His death. Now, if we can help you with that, we're happy and willing to do that. Maybe you've obeyed the gospel and you're not faithful. You're not loyal. Well, you need to correct that, because you'll answer to the God who made us for that. If we can help you with that and make that known, while together we stand, Bruce, and while we sing the song.